You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, March 30th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building, in the fashionable Dollar Lunch Dick. It's hump day, folks! And we are just barely getting over the hump today. We're going to be welcoming on the program Wes in Japan, that is Wes Cheek. And we will also be talking to Jeff Cohen of Roots Action, formerly founder of FAIR, still founder of FAIR. We will get to that in a moment. I'm expecting Wes to call back in just a moment. Today also may be the day that I get off the Libya bus, as it were. Again, expecting Wes to call in just any moment now. But according to the New York Times, the Obama administration is engaged in a fierce debate over whether to supply weapons to the rebels in Libya. This is following a meeting of the NATO allies in London. But we will talk more about that in a moment. Now let's talk to Wes in Japan, calling us from the northern part of Japan as he treks his way through the tsunami and earthquake ravaged part of the country. Wes, you there?
Yes, I'm here. It's a trek, Sam. It's a trek.
So tell us what you have. I should just remind everybody, Wes Creek, you can check out his blog at Space Travels a Crime and his Twitter feed, Wes in Japan. I know I said cheek yesterday. What? I corrected myself. After
No. You said cheek.
It is cheek. Oh, my God.
You can do it. You can do it. It's
West
so
Cheek.
Easy that I think you will have to mess it up. Yeah.
Wes Cheek. Oh, my gosh.
That's right.
And now you've got me all spun around.
That's right.
All right, so Wes.
All right.
No problem. Yeah. Listen, I get it, too. It hasn't hurt my career in one bit. So tell me. All right, so where are you now? Where did you travel? Just remind people, it is about midnight your time in Japan. Where are you, and where have you traveled today?
Well, I'm at the same place I have been calling you from, where I come back to every night. But actually, all the rooms were full tonight, but we managed to squeak in, because there are a lot of... I said yesterday, I was talking about how you don't see many relief teams, and I want to clarify that a little bit. I haven't seen them in the kind of really rural areas we've been at, but it's a hotel we're staying at, and all the hotels in the area are full of, I think, lots of government teams and kind of railroad repair specialists and road repair specialists and helicopter pilots and things like that. So the hotels are out here really full. But yesterday I told you I haven't seen many foreign aid groups, so I kind of went out looking for them today. And me and Ethan, the news photographer that I'm traveling with, we drove down south to Ishinomaki in Miyagi Prefecture, which is on the news a lot. It's kind of a larger city. And we first went to the Red Cross Hospital just to have a look around. And it's just amazing to see, like, all of the action that's going on down there, like all the Red Cross volunteers and all the Red Cross workers and just kind of the whole setup there. It's a really, like, headquarters. And we ran into, by accident, a guy named, his last name is Yoshi Goe, and he works for a design firm, and he's designed these kind of like temporary housing out of paper. He was inspired by origami, by Japanese origami, And so it's kind of this paper, like kind of cardboard you can fold up and stack in a moving van, about 100 of them, and then you kind of take them out and assemble them, and it's kind of maybe like a hexagon, maybe, mm-hmm. and it's much more sturdy than a tent, and he's housing Red Cross workers in them. And that was kind of amazing to run into him. And then we drove over to, I believe the reading is Senshu University, I think it's called, and that's where the organization, it's an NGO called Peace Boat. I don't know if many people in America are familiar with them, but they're very big here in Japan. They have a boat that goes around the world once or twice a year and takes volunteers and paying customers to different conflict areas to do peace studies. And they're just, man, they're so amazing. I'm so heartened by what they're doing. They're so organized, and they've been up here since, I believe, 6 days after the tsunami. And they're collecting supplies from all over Japan and all over the world and kind of processing them in their center there, which is all volunteers in like a big shack just kind of sorting out supplies. They're figuring out who needs what, and they have trucks. They have 7 volunteer teams and about 50 to 100 volunteers who go out in teams and take these relief supplies to individual families. And it's not the families that are in shelters, because those are being taken care of by the military and the government. It's people who are still in their houses but don't have enough to eat or don't have enough supplies. And so that's where we were today.
So, Peace Boat, people can find it online. We'll try and put a link to them. It's also been suggested.
Yeah, they're great.
It's been suggested to me that if people want to contribute to the Red Cross, they should contribute directly to the Japanese Red Cross to ensure that it gets right to those people. Have you had any other conversations, stories that you can relate to us?
Yeah, it's a great story today. When we were out, we went with the Peace Boat people to make their rounds and drop off supplies, and we went out to a neighborhood called Shirasagi-dai, the neighborhood. And it's hard to say, like, we've been in real, just completely destroyed areas. In this area, if you didn't know there's a tsunami, there's just no damage there. It looks like a really nice, upscale neighborhood. But even the upscale neighborhoods, when they have, you know, no water and no food and no gasoline, it's not a good situation. And we met a family called the Uematsu family, where most of them lived down by the harbor and lost their whole house. And, like, one of the brothers has a house up on this hill, so 17 members of the family are living there. And the older brother, whose house was destroyed, Mr. Uematsu, he had called Peace Boat and got these relief supplies to come out to the neighborhood. And when we first got there, he came up to the truck and he said, look, just we have to make sure that the people who lost everything get like a first go at this stuff. And so they organized it that way, and Mr. Uematsu, who in fact himself lost everything, waited until everyone had gone and kind of went through the line last and kind of tried to make it as much not about himself as possible. And it was just so amazing to watch, because I know you don't want people getting political on your show, Sam. I know you try to stay really middle of the road and play close to the vest. But it was just so amazing to watch that and kind of watch, you know, we have people in America like, oh, how can I figure out how to pay zero taxes on anything, and how can I figure out how to be as rich as possible? And here these people who have absolutely nothing, we're all trying to make sure that everyone went ahead of them and tried to get in line ahead of them, and everyone had enough. And they didn't want to take too much until they made sure that everyone had what they needed. And then Mr. Uematsu, like, was telling me the story about his kid's elementary school graduation yesterday. And I was telling him, oh, don't start on a graduation story, because I teach school, too, and that'll just be too much for me. That'll be it. And he's like, no, come in and watch the video. And he got me to come in his house, and it was the graduation. And it was the Peace Boat volunteers had gone and cleaned out a room of the school so that they could have graduation ceremonies, and had made their diplomas for them because they'd lost their diplomas in the tsunami. And their homeroom teacher made a speech at graduation, and he said, my favorite memory from this year was a time capsule that we all made, and we were supposed to come back in 20 years and dig it up. He's like, I'm sorry, the time capsule's, you know, it's gone now. But I've always been a very strict teacher and given you lots of homework, but I have one last homework assignment for you, and that is I want you to come back here in 20 years on March 11th, and let's all get together and talk about what's happened in those last 20 years. That was about all I could watch in that video. It was very, very moving. And then just that whole family, that whole neighborhood, were just so amazing in the way they're kind of just laughing and hanging out. And, like, it's a terrible situation. They all know it's terrible, but they're just really great, strong people. And so that was good to see today. After a week of climbing through rubble and seeing dead cows and whatever else, today was inspiring.
Well, it's a touching story. And so tell me just briefly, we just got a minute, what are the rest of your plans for the week?
Well, I'm going to have to head back on Friday because I've only got a rental car for a week, and I don't make $1 million a year. So I can't stay up here forever, but I really want to come back. So tomorrow we're going to drive further south, maybe get down to Sendai, some of the major like urban areas that were affected, and kind of see what's going on there, and then gradually make our way back to Kyoto so that the rental company who thinks that I'm out camping at the beach right now, I told them that's what I was doing with the car, not driving to a disaster area. So we have to get the car back to them and then take a break. And maybe if there's any way, although my wife might not permit it, I want to try to come back up here because it's just there's so much going on up here. It's really an amazing story up here. So.
All right. Well, Wes, thanks so much. We will talk to you again tomorrow, I guess, and at the same time.
Sure.
And be safe and appreciate the report.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sam.
Okay. Wes in Japan. It is Wes Cheek. Wes Cheek. You can visit his blog at Space Travel. Space Travels, a crime. Just one brief update here on the Libyan situation. I began to tell you that the Obama administration's engaged in a supposedly a fierce debate over whether to supply weapons to the rebels in Libya. Apparently, counteroffensive by Muammar Gaddafi's forces yesterday had driven rebels back. It's unclear what the situation is there. There's you know, again, it's very difficult to really get a sense of what's going on. There are questions as to who are in the rebel force. Apparently, the commander of NATO, Admiral James Stavridis. I should also mention that people have been talking about my pronunciation just about everything. I got people you were talking about, Carolyn Ray, that I'm mispronouncing everything. That's part of the show, folks. That is built into the show. I try and mispronounce everyone's name so that I don't have to pronounce anyone's name properly. He told a Senate hearing that there were flickers in intelligence reports about the presence of al-Qaeda and Hezbollah among members of the anti-Gaddafi forces. The French government, which has led the international charge against Gaddafi, has placed mounting pressure on the United States to provide greater assistance to the rebels. The question of how best to support the opposition dominated an international conference about Libya on Thursday and Tuesday in London, as I mentioned. Clinton said the administration had not yet decided whether to actually transfer arms, but she reiterated the United States had the right to do so despite an arms embargo on Libya because the United Nations Security Council's broad resolution authorizing military action to protect civilians. I'm sorry, folks. This is where I get off the boat. I do not know how you can say you're protecting civilians because once you give them weapons and training, which, of course, is necessary with these weapons, are they still civilians? I mean, and forget the sort of syllogistic or logical issue with that. That is not what the mandate is. And frankly, I feel that we have fulfilled the UN mandate. And if it involves a scaled-down version of what we've been doing to ensure that there is no wholesale slaughter of civilians, then I continue to support that. But when we start to arm and train the rebels, and which is even beyond what they have asked for, Obama says, I'm not ruling it out, but I'm also not ruling it in, whatever that means. But these rebels would need to be trained. Unfortunately, in London, the NATO-led operation would only end with the removal of Colonel Gaddafi, as suggested by Clinton and other Western leaders in London the other day. And again, that is beyond the stated goal of the United Nations mandate. A quote from a spokesman for the rebels, Mahmoud Shamam. We ask for political support more than arms, but if we get both, that would be good. Well, I'm afraid I get off the bus when we go beyond political support. I do think that humanitarian aid and money, it's been suggested that perhaps some of the $30 billion in frozen Libyan funds be channeled to the opposition. I don't have a problem with that. But they're just going to have to buy their weapons somewhere else. I don't think that we have the ability, aside from the moral question, I don't think we have the ability to get involved in this conflict beyond where we are involved. And just as one could argue that, well, you're still leaving the civilians in danger, it is possible that we are. But we have prevented a massacre. That is what the UN mandated. And we need to be able to exercise the discipline not going any further. To those who suggest that by fulfilling the UN mandate, it was inevitable, well, it's no more or less inevitable than our involvement in the first place. At one point or another, we're going to have to exercise some discipline and not get involved if that is genuinely the agenda of the United States. And, you know, we can talk later about whether or not are there indications that there may be another agenda afoot. In the meantime, we will be right back. We will talk with Jeff Cohen from RootsAction.org. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Jeff Cohen, a founder of FAIR and a co-founder of the new online activist organization, RootsAction.org. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Nice to be with you.
So, Jeff, let's tell me first about Roots Action. What is this organization? Why did you co-found this organization? What are you hoping to achieve with it?
I guess we thought that the liberal Netroots, which had accomplished so much in resisting the invasion of Iraq when the Democrats in Washington had largely caved in, that a lot of the Netroots groups over the years had grown too close to the leadership of the Democratic Party. Which is why, while millions of members of the Netroots supported things like a thorough investigation of Bush, leading perhaps to impeachment hearings, that kind of thing was never mentioned by groups like Move On, even though a lot of their base wanted it. And after Pelosi became the Speaker of the House, there wasn't really a serious effort by the Democratic leadership to end the Iraq occupation, but that's what many people in the liberal Netroots wanted. But the Netroots leadership wasn't pushing for that. So I think the goal of RootsAction.org is to be a more independent online action group. There is a huge group of people, several million, every day get their news from independent outlets, whether it's Common Dreams or Truth Out or Truth Dig or Democracy Now or Grit TV or Majority Report. And they know that the problem isn't just that the right wingers are extremist, anti-intellectual, anti-science, but that part of the problem is that the Democratic leadership is corrupt and corporatized. And so it's those few million people that get the news from independent media we felt needed an action group online that practiced independent politics, independent of the Democratic leadership. That's the gist of RootsAction.org.
Do you think the I don't know that I could agree more with your assessment of what the problem is. But do you think part of it is because I think one of the things that I think we found in the context of the Democrats, at least when they had control of every aspect of our government, was that the Netroots were simply very easy to ignore by the Obama administration. And do you think also that the problem, at least I perceive it, is that the liberal advocacy groups, the longtime liberal advocacy groups, the ones that whose online campaigns are secondary to their existence,
yeah.
It has has really, in some, has been very problematic in this sense. And people have referred to it as the veal pen. Tell me about that.
I agree with that analysis. I'm a little older than a lot of the people that started Netroots groups. I go back, I became active in high school against the Vietnam War. So I've seen this going on for decades, where the Beltway liberal groups, whether feminist, unions, environmentalist, civil rights, they've become very used to getting very little from the Democrats in Washington, but taking solace in the fact that they get invited to dinners. They know these people. They know the president. They know the Speaker of the House when it was Pelosi and earlier incarnations.
And they get funding. And they get funding.
No doubt. No doubt. But they rarely achieve for their millions of constituents, tens of millions of constituents, what those constituents want. I've had a unique experience in that for many, many years, I was a bona fide advocate for the left on American mainstream television. Mm-hmm. And I was never allowed on TV without being in a debate with a right-winger. So I got to know the leaders of the right-wingers beginning in the 1980s, the national right-wing leadership. I know them. These are people that burn with passion to transform America. They don't talk about, oh, our friends on the Hill, like the liberal leaders do. They really want to transform America. They have transformed America. And it seems like, and these people burn to transform America in your view, in my view, totally in the wrong direction. But these are people that will not stop. And if their current Republican leadership doesn't give them what they want, they go and elect a new Republican leadership.
That's right.
On the other hand, the liberal establishment, and I never thought this would happen so fast to the liberal Netroots, all you get is a lot of rhetoric and apology whenever the Democrats are in power. And, you know, I was very active in writing a nationally syndicated newspaper column when Clinton was in the White House, the Democrats controlled the Senate, and the Democrats controlled the House, and it's exactly what happened when Obama was the president and the Democrats controlled the Senate and House. The agendas just were not pushed. The promises that were made to get elected were broken, and the leadership of the liberal pressure groups, instead of applying pressure, they applied pressure on, instead of applying pressure on the Democratic leadership, they would apply pressure on their own base to quiet down. That's something the right-wing leaders, activist leaders, never do. They always threaten to punish the Republicans if they don't get their agenda, and it's not a surprise that these right-wing grassroots groups have largely taken over. Obviously, they're corporate funded, but they've largely taken over one of the two major parties, while the major party that's supposed to speak for the middle class and the working class and minorities and women, you know, that party keeps getting more and more conservative, more and more corrupt, more and more corporate. I think a classic example of what's happened in the last couple weeks is we have a new war going on, and we have big corporations not paying a penny in taxes, and these are the kinds of people that Obama hangs out with. It's just, it's not the Democratic Party leadership that the progressive base of America, and I believe that's tens of millions of people, want. And the only way we'll ever get a Democratic Party leadership of the kind we want is if the liberal groups and the Netroots groups start acting independently, start acting with militants, intelligent militants, informed militants, but that we won't tolerate what's going on. I mean, our country is cracking up this week, and it's like, you know, you wouldn't know it from Move On. You wouldn't know it from a lot of the liberal groups inside the Beltway. You wouldn't know that our society is collapsing. Corporations are paying no taxes. Unions are being busted. A new war has opened up against another Islamic country. It's like we're not, you know, waking up and smelling the coffee.
Do you think that there is a my sense is that the I think because we've just come through a period where there's been so much disillusionment on the left with what's happened, that there has been sort of an increase in awareness that whether it's, you know, studies that show over the past 30 years, regardless of what party is in power, the policies that are implemented more closely align with the top quintile of income distribution in this country than the 80% below. That we do see a situation where we're seeing austerity brought in at a time where our taxes are at an all-time low relative to GDP over the past 60 years. Is there a fundamental, I mean, one of the frustrations that I have with what has happened, that seems to keep the left from mobilizing properly in this country is that, there has been obviously this corruption of the, liberal leadership in, you know, the so-called liberal leadership, by money, frankly. And,
But that doesn't have to be. I mean, if you look back in the 20th century at the times where our country took giant steps forward in a progressive direction, it was because there were independent, progressive grassroots groups that pushed on the Democrats when they were in power. So in the 30s, you had these strong workers' movements in the beginning of the CIO industrial unions. You had a bunch of socialist groups out there in the 30s. And the FDR had a very moderate program when he ran for president in 1932, but within 4 or 5 years had transformed the country because these grassroots groups demanded it. The same thing happened in the 1960s. You know, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Students for a Democratic Society, Martin Luther King and SCLC. These civil rights groups were constantly pushing on the Kennedy brothers from 61 to 63, constantly pushing on LBJ. They were independent. They didn't make strategy with LBJ. They knew that they had to keep pushing on him or there would not be the landmark civil rights legislation that we ultimately got. So I think the lesson of the 30s and the 60s is your groups have to be independent. You can't make strategy with the Democratic leadership because they'll always say the time isn't right.
Right.
That's what they told Martin Luther King every month, the Kennedy brothers, President Johnson, the time isn't right. Please don't have a demonstration. Please don't have a march on Washington. And they just kept pushing and pushing. Now, that's what right-wing groups have done for the last 30 years.
And they electorally challenge. I mean, you've got the Club for Growth now has one of their own, you know, Pat Toomey. Before there was a Tea Party, there was the Club for Growth and Grover Norquist.
Right.
The odd thing is simply at that level, too, Grover Norquist is not a pariah. In the way that anybody on the left who had attempted to do such a thing would be a pariah. I mean, we would get a resolution on the floor of the House condemning that group.
Yeah, but you want to know something? It shouldn't bother us. I mean, I know you're agreeing. If there was an independent left, an independent grassroots progressive groups that actually represented the millions of people in this country that want change, need change, we wouldn't care about what the Democrats did initially. Ultimately, we would start having forces that could win local elections, win statewide elections. Democrats would need us, but they don't need you when they can take you for granted because they know you're going to go quiet while they're violating your central principles.
So tactically, let's drill down on this a little bit. I mean, tactically speaking, is your organization something that is designed to simply I don't mean to minimize this. I think it's absolutely crucial to essentially expand the so-called Overton window by making the playing field, by essentially giving voice to those who have been marginalized so that we're actually moving the margins of the debate to the left as opposed to having this constant center-center-right, center-far-right policy argument.
Yeah, that's the exact idea. I mean, there are proposals that will solve the problems of the American people. They're never heard because the Democratic corporatized leadership will never put them forward. The right wing always wants to take us backward. And so there has to be a group that says, this is what America needs. Well, you know, for health care, we need Medicare for all. Just take away the age limit of 65. We need to drastically cut the military budget. We need corporations to pay their taxes. We need a tax on Wall Street transactions. That will not only minimize speculation, it'll actually bring in revenue. We need to embolden unions and make sure if a majority of workers in a workplace want to be in a union, they're in a union. You know, it may be that initially these proposals cannot pass Congress. We know that. But unless there's a group in American society that speaks for the working class and the middle class and the poor, you know, poor is not a word that Barack Obama will ever use, unless there's a group that speaks for the 80% of us, then obviously no politician will ever have to deal with initiatives that speak for the 80% of us. And that's the goal, is to widen the debate. You know, if Move On has 5 million people, and those 5 million people clearly want change, but when the Democrats control all levers of power, Move On sort of doesn't push for change, then the cloud of those 5 million people is really weakened.
Right.
So our goal is to build, you know, I'd be happy with a 500,000 list soon, and really start getting that 500,000 people who, by the way, get their news from people like you, from Amy Goodman, from Bob Scheer and Truth Dig, from Common Dreams, from Laura Flanders and Grit. I mean, that's the beauty. You know, I teach at Ithaca College in the journalism department. I'm the head of the Park Center for Independent Media. Independent media have boomed in the last 10 years.
Yes.
They're independent of the conglomerates. They're independent of the two-party system. They say what's wrong with both leaderships of both parties. And so there's millions of people for the first time. I grew up in the 60s. I don't think the so-called underground press was reaching so many people with such informed analysis that we get today. So there's these millions of people that get the independent media. What they don't have is independent politics and mobilization that would go with their information.
So the idea is you build an organization, you build a list where you can contact people who are like-minded, and then what's the next step? I mean, are you going to be focusing on building sort of transpartisan coalitions? Is it going to be championing certain issues? Is it going to be protests? I mean, what's the best, you know, I mean, in you know, I hope people, I probably should have included this in your introduction, but you are probably one of the, I don't know, the intersection between your genuine liberalism and the time that you have spent on cable TV.
Yep.
I think I don't know if there's anybody, frankly, who, short of maybe one or two people who are now on MSNBC,
right.
And I say one or two lightly, you were the executive producer of Donahue before he was pulled off before the war. You were on you were a host of Crossfire. You were on Fox for a while.
Yeah.
You were on CNN. You've been places that no one was allowed to go.
Right.
Is it something that you will focus on trying to get these voices in the media more, or is it going to be all of the above?
Yeah, all of the above. I like your last point. The bigger our movement is demanding that certain reforms happen, then, you know, before you know it, the mainstream media, hey, what is this thing about Medicare for all? Or what is the, you know, what is this upsurge about putting a tax on all Wall Street transactions, a tiny tax that would mitigate speculation and bring in revenue? You know, if you get enough people behind something from the grassroots, then the Democratic Congress members will follow. This is how we ended the Vietnam War. And then after some Democratic Congress members follow, again, you don't strategize with the Democratic leadership. You tell them what you want, and then politicians will come to you. And then before you know it, you are on mainstream media.
Right.
And you are on mainstream media talking about the issues you want talked about. But we're at a point where independent media is so powerful, you know, the cracking open the mainstream media, to me, is no longer the main priority. It's transforming the Democratic Party. It's transforming politics. At a certain point, and this is what's so sad about some of the Netroots groups that, you know, began 8, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and built up such lists and have accomplished so little in terms of transforming the Democratic Party. They've in many cases just sort of melded into the Democratic Party. But at some point, Roots Action would probably set up a PAC and start running in key races to elect the kinds of people that so that the Dennis Kuciniches and the Barbara Lees don't always look like they're somehow crazed. And Bernie Sanders, you know, the idea is we know there are politicians in Washington that propose things that will actually solve the problems of the majority of the American people. What we need instead of a few of them is dozens of them. We aren't going to get dozens of them until we build independent grassroots power. The right wing took over the Republican Party. I watched it happen over the last 30 years. They told me sometimes in green rooms, I was appearing on national TV from the mid 80s on, and I would always debate these guys. We knew what they were doing. They said what they were doing. They did what they said they were going to do. And we here sit among progressives. Gee, how do we change things? You change things by being independent, demanding what you want, and primarying corporate Democrats. But not the main thing you got to do is tell the truth. You can't pretend that Obama has a progressive agenda. If I get one more email alert from one of these liberal groups telling me we have to stand up for President Obama's progressive agenda, or it just drives the millions of people that know better crazy. I mean, when I was starting to organize to raise money for RootsAction.org, I'd say, well, the idea is to have an online action group that actually has principles and tells the truth. And they said, I would get from person after, oh, you mean how MoveOn used to be?
Right.
I said, yes, exactly. Except we're not going to cave in toward the Democratic leadership.
Now, let me ask you this, Jeff Cohen from RootsAction.org. I know you got to run. We just got one more minute here. But what do you say to people who say, okay, the only way to achieve this type of dynamic that you're referring to is to build a third party? What's your sense about that?
I would be with them, except we are in a political system where third parties are almost outlawed. The system basically makes them unworkable at a national level. We are our country was devised, our system of politics and Congress, our parliament was a Congress. It was 18th century. They didn't know anything about proportional representation back then. They didn't know anything about, if you can get 5% for your Green Party, you become a member of the parliament or a member of Congress. So we're unfortunately in a system where while it's not in the Constitution to have a two-party system, the Constitution has almost made third parties at the national level impossible. And I would be completely pessimistic at hearing your question if we hadn't seen in our own lifetime an example of how right-wing movements had taken over a major party. Right. There's no reason progressive movements can't take over this party. The Democrats, where more black people are, more working-class people are, more union members are, more feminists are, more environmentalists are. I mean, we know there are millions of people who want fundamental change. They're just poorly represented, not only by the Democratic elected officials, but what you and I started talking about at the very beginning here. Poorly represented by the liberal pressure groups inside the Beltway and even now the online groups that have become too cozy with Democratic Party leadership.
In the final analysis, what we're talking about is the value of stridency.
No doubt. It's the value of independence. In our country, we talk about live free or die. Progressives are the only ones who are so easy to just cave. You need to be independent of the political system, because if you're not, the corporations have a stranglehold over, as you had said, but Republicans and Democrats. Wall Street gave more money to Obama than any candidate in history. He's close to Jeff Immelt of General Electric. He's close to the people at Goldman Sachs. I mean, Obama knows how to speak liberal rhetoric when needed during elections, but he has governed for a very small class of people. And he's very comfortable doing that. And again,
I think that in the final analysis, that's the more relevant part. I mean, if you look at he has raised more money from Wall Street than any candidate in the past, but he's also raised more money from anybody. But I think that he actually believes these people know what they're talking about. I think he actually believes that they are in the right.
I mean, I've written column after column about Obama since the campaign, and obviously I wanted him to win and did my part to make sure McCain didn't win. But if you analyze him from beginning, I remember in April of 2009 when he's on a plane with two New York Times reporters and President Obama was asked, what do you say to these right-wingers who say you're putting forward socialist proposals? And he sort of laughed. And then he felt the need, as soon as he got off the plane, to assure the New York Times reporter who'd interviewed him, look, I want to make sure you understand that every single proposal I'm putting forward is fully in keeping with free market principles. Now, anyone, when the corporate system had almost collapsed in the spring of 2009, anyone who's still giving you the rhetoric of free market principles is someone who really is speaking the language of big business.
Right.
Because, you know, we don't have free market. We have a few corporations that dominate virtually every industry, and a Wall Street that dominates all other industries because they can crater the whole global economy. Obama's a smart guy. When he talks that language, when he's out there with Jeff Immelt, who's laid off more workers, pays no taxes for General Electric, and he puts him the head of the Jobs Commission, again, it's almost farce. The people who are more independent of Barack Obama than MoveOn and the liberal net roots groups and the liberal pressure groups in the Beltway is Jon Stewart,
right,
or Colbert. You know, they're making fun of, this is almost beyond parody what Obama is doing. And every night you can laugh about it with the Stewart Show or Colbert. But, you know, that's why we need independent politics, so we can, you know, stand up to the madness instead of pretending it isn't mad.
RootsAction.org. Jeff Cohen, thanks so much for spending time with us. I hope to talk to you again in the near future.
Sounds great. Thanks, Sam. Bye-bye.
All right, folks. That's today's program. We will be back tomorrow with more program. If you're a member, please join me on the other side, on the flip side. And if you're listening live, you can IM me at Majority FM. Be right back after this.
Hey, folks, as I always say, your membership is the only thing that will ensure we can keep doing this daily show. So please, if you can do it, join today at majority.fm. Not only will you help support the show and keep it alive, but you'll also get an extra 50 minutes a day of programming. Plus, you're going to get all sorts of other bonus membership gifts and some swag. So what's not to love? But if you still are holding out, you can help the show by doing virtually nothing in other ways. Head to majority.fm, find the Majority FM Amazon.com graphic, click on it, bookmark it, buy goods from Amazon as you normally would. You will absolutely notice no difference. But meanwhile, you'll be redistributing wealth from a corporate behemoth, Amazon, to the independent media you listen to daily, the Majority Report. It's simple, and it really, really helps. So please, if you can do it, and buy your goods from our Amazon link right now and help support the media you love.